sisters, the time has come for each and every one of you to decide whether you are going to be the problem or whether you are going to be the solution.
That's right.
You must choose, brothers. You must choose.
The climate is changing three times faster than our worst predictions.
That's the headline from the Independent newspaper in Britain, June 3rd. Get ready for the awful truth, because for the next hour, you are tuned to Radio EcoShock. They have found that emissions of carbon dioxide have been rising at three times the rate in the 1990s. The Arctic ice cap is melting three times as fast, and the seas are rising twice as rapidly as had been predicted, says The Independent. According to the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, CO2 emissions have been increasing by 3% a year in the last decade, compared to only 1.1% in the early 1990s. That's a much greater rate of carbon dumping than even the worst assumptions by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in their latest report. The National Academy finds 3/4 of the added greenhouse gases now come from the developing world, principally China, the world's factory. But Americans won't need carbon envy anytime soon. They still top the world for carbon waste. On average, every U.S. citizen emits 6 times more greenhouse gases than a Chinese person. Meanwhile, the IPCC estimated Arctic ice declined 2.5% every decade over the last 50 years. Now, the University of California's National Snow and Ice Data Center shows that Arctic ice has declined by 7.8% a decade, 3 times more than the conservative Intergovernmental Panel consensus. We haven't been told the whole truth. The climate situation is much worse than even the most pessimistic experts had claimed. Forget all that talk about limiting global warming to 2 degrees. We're already heading for at least 4 degrees warmer, plenty hot enough to thaw the big northern carbon freezer, the Arctic permafrost. It's all positive feedback from there on out. What's so positive about it? Well, let's listen to this explanation from David Wasdell of meridian.org.uk.
Whether or not I'm an expert is not the point, but what on earth are feedbacks? Well, I think one of the best ways of understanding this, you know, is to talk about water vapor feedback, and then we can understand what a feedback is from this. Now, obviously, water evaporates from the ocean and from vegetation and from land surfaces if they're a bit wet, and forests and so on. So we get humidity in the atmosphere. The more water vapor there is in the atmosphere, the more the atmosphere acts like a greenhouse and traps heat near the surface, doesn't let it go back out into space. In other words, water vapour is a very powerful greenhouse gas. Not just carbon dioxide, water vapour is a greenhouse gas. So let's think a bit. As soon as global warming starts, the seas get a bit warmer, the air gets a bit warmer, evaporation increases, there's more water vapour in the atmosphere, so it acts as a better insulator. So it gets warmer. So that means more evaporation takes place, so more water vapour gets into the atmosphere, which means that the atmosphere works better to insulate the Earth, so it gets warmer still, which means that we then get more water vapour up into the atmosphere, and this can run away. In other words, the hotter it gets, the hotter it gets, tiddly-pom, as A.A. Milne would have written if he was talking and writing with Christopher Robin today. That's what a feedback mechanism does. It amplifies what is already happening and makes it a lot worse. Now, in the strange way that professionals create a jargon that completely misinterprets everything for us lay people, positive feedback is the bad guy and negative feedback is the good guy. Positive feedback amplifies global warming and makes it worse. Negative feedback damps global warming and helps us to get into a good, sustainable, viable environment. So I'm not going to use positive and negative feedbacks, and if I do, I hope I'll be able to recover from the mistake. Let's talk about amplifying feedbacks and damping feedbacks. Another amplifying feedback has to do with the reflection of sunlight from snow and ice, white, almost like a mirror pushing light energy back out into space. And obviously, as the ice sheets melt, as the glaciers withdraw, as the amount of snow on the ground retracts up the mountains, as less snow falls, as the tundra permafrost no longer holds snowpack on top of it, but just looks like brown, muddy, bobbling mud and bog, there's much less reflection. In fact, when the ice sheets withdraw and we get shrinking polar ice, you've just got dark water exposed to the sunlight, and that absorbs the sunlight instead of it's getting reflected back out. So the less snow and ice there is, the less energy we reflect back out, the more heat we retain near the surface, the warmer the water gets, the more the ice melts, the less snow is around, the less energy is reflected back out, so the hotter it gets, and we have a runaway feedback process which feeds on itself and amplifies global warming. There are about 20 of these different feedback mechanisms, you know, and it's not just about water vapour and ice and reflection. There are lots of others happening. I'll give you a for instance. The more carbon dioxide there is in the air, the more the surface of the sea gets acidic. Now, the more acid there is in the water, the less it absorbs carbon dioxide. And the less CO2 gets absorbed, the more stays in the atmosphere, which makes it get hotter. And hotter water doesn't absorb gas as much either. So that prevents it absorbing carbon dioxide. So the higher the concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere, and the hotter it gets, the less effective the global commons, as we call them, the oceans are, to take up and absorb the pollution that we're already putting out. So even if we keep emissions right down, and the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere stays stable, we think, the fact that the oceans are absorbing more and that they're getting warmer means that there is actually more and more carbon dioxide staying in the atmosphere. And so we talk about sink degrade as an amplifying feedback.
Toss out the history books, the geography books, the biology books. It's a whole new game.
We got global warming and SUVs. We got open borders and minimum wage freeze. We got wars going on all over the place. I'm getting kind of worried about the human race. We got them 21st century blues. Just keep a having to pay more dues. Preacher saying it's the end of times. Show feeling like it's the end of man. We got corporations riding on our backs. Pushing so hard we're having heart attacks. Ain't nothing matters but the bottom line. A paying me nothing for my overtime. We got them 21st. A century blues. Just keep a having to pay more dues. Preacher saying it's the end of times. Sure feeling like it's the end of mine.
Yeah, the 21st century blues from Preston Highway. This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Today on Radio EcoShock, we're going to concentrate on just one aspect of climate change, the water cycle and extreme water events. We have two guests. Dr. Noah Diffenbaugh of Purdue University is an expert climate modeler. He has mapped out the future of North America in the most detail yet. We'll be talking about who gets wet and who gets none, plus the worrying phenomenon of extreme rain events. Then Cleo Wolfe Erskine describes the new book, Damnation, a collection of investigations going from simple backyard gray water treatment that you could do, all the way to a world overview of the way humans divert water. People who come from drought-stricken areas think climate change will dry out the world, but try telling that to those displaced by floods and extreme rainfall. To help sort out the confusion, we are joined by Dr. Noah Diffenbaugh, a climate scientist from Purdue University in Indiana. Dr. Diffenbaugh, why are you in Italy these days?
I have some close collaborators here at the Abdus-Salam Institute, so we're working on our next piece of climate science.
And in 2005, your team released one of the most detailed climate model predictions for North America. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so we set out to try to capture the role of fine-scale climate processes and how those processes might shape climate change in North America, and particularly the United States, going forward over the next several decades. And when I say fine-scale processes, I really mean, you know, the sorts of details that are operating on, you know, tens to hundreds of kilometers and over the course of days that aren't captured as thoroughly in global climate models as we would like.
And what did you come out, you know, what can we expect in North America? Can you tell us briefly?
Well, we found that elevated greenhouse gas concentrations substantially increase the frequency of extreme precipitation events, and also the contribution of those events to the total annual precipitation. So not only do the heaviest events become more frequent as greenhouse gas concentrations rise, but they also represent a larger fraction of the total precipitation that comes during the year. Now, we also we've also found increased drought in some areas, and so the seasonal component to this story is very important.
Well, that's really the problem from my perspective. Our second guest on this show comes from the U.S. Southwest. It's been very dry there. They've had an unusual winter fire season in California. And he wonders if it's the same here in British Columbia. But no, we've just had 150% of the normal winter snowpack. And as we speak, one of North America's big river systems, the Fraser, is flooding despite a multi-million dollar crash effort in dike building. Is the world dividing into wets and dries?
Well, I think that it's overly simplistic to say that the dry areas will get drier and the wet areas will get wetter. And certainly that rule of thumb is being promoted in various venues. You know, the precipitation is the hardest part of sort of day-to-day climate for us to get right in terms of understanding the physical processes and modeling the physical processes that govern it. So it's also, you know, the part of the climate system that directly affects humans and natural ecosystems that we have the least certainty about. You know, we certainly, one of the main features of our study is that there are parts of the year that become wetter and parts of the year that become drier. So if you look at the desert Southwest, for example, we found that extreme precipitation is likely to increase, and total annual precipitation is likely to increase, but that will come with an exacerbation of summer drought.
So how is that? Isn't that going to impact agriculture if we can't really count on the rain coming when we're trying to grow the crops?
Well, it certainly could impact agriculture, and we have a number of studies ongoing now to try to understand how agriculture might be impacted by these fine-scale climate changes. You know, humans are pretty ingenious about controlling the environment, if not directly manipulating the climate system, at least adapting to it. So, you know, I think the real question is how are these changes going to play out in a temporal fashion in terms of the kind of warning that planners have? Are these going to be gradual changes? Are they going to be abrupt changes? And also, what's the cost of adapting to those changes? Are areas that are, you know, have invested a lot of infrastructure, both physical and social, in a certain way of life in terms of particular crops that they grow and the infrastructure that goes around that, are they going to have to change on the fly? And what can we do now to try to prepare for that uncertainty? I think those are key questions.
I read recently that stormwater specifications for U.S. city planning is based mainly on figures from the 1960s and often from Louisiana studies. With climate change, do we need to rethink and then maybe even rebuild some of our plans for flash flooding?
Well, I'm not a city planner and I'm not a civil engineer, so you know how those plans are made is certainly not my area of expertise. So I wouldn't want to tread too heavily on those waters, but I will say that we know that climate varies, and really at any location, planning over several decades from data from a single decade is going to be precarious in and of itself, independent of climate change. So the variability component is critical, and a lot of the influence that climate exerts on human populations is through that variability. When you have a change in the forcing of the climate system, which is what humans are doing now with greenhouse gas emissions, one of the big questions is how is that variability going to be altered? And there's a lot of evidence that that variability will indeed be altered by greenhouse warming. So I think that, you know, certainly planning for uncertainty and planning for variability is always going to be the most likely bet when you're talking about decadal scale climate.
I've seen conflicting reports about the role that particulates in the air, or smog, has played on precipitation. How did you add that impact into your modeling?
Well, not as thoroughly as we'd like to. So, you know, how smog affects cloud microphysical processes, cloud condensation nuclei, and those sorts of very very detailed processes is still something that we as a climate community are working hard on. So we have the dynamics, so the convection and large-scale circulation, we have that treated at much higher resolution than in, say, a global climate model. And that certainly helps our simulation of precipitation in many areas, as does our better treatment of topography. But in terms of pollution, that's something that we haven't treated very explicitly.
Because we're getting reports that there's more coming over from Asia, not that we can blame Asia for our own decades of greenhouse gas pollution, but that, you know, as China and India gear up, there's more smog drifting all the way over the Pacific to the West Coast.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's certainly a whole battery of studies that suggest that sort of pollution can impact precipitation. It's not, and again, I'm not a cloud microphysicist, but there certainly are examples of it increasing precipitation by providing cloud condensation nuclei, and also there's a well-known effect by which pollution can also suppress precipitation. So a lot of it depends on which kind of pollution you're talking about and how big those particles are. They actually can act in either direction.
Well, that's what makes it so difficult for the general public to get a grip on what climate change really means. Not only are we on the cutting edge of something, but that it can have different impacts. So if you could boil down some of the precipitation predictions to a few basic concepts for us, what would they be? What should we be learning about?
Well, the conceptual model that's been around for quite a while is that elevated greenhouse gas concentrations will enhance the hydrologic cycle, and this will tend to result in more heavy precipitation events and longer dry spells. So basically, as the atmosphere warms, it'll hold more water. When a precipitation event is triggered, more water will fall out of the atmosphere, and then it will take longer for that to recharge, is the basic conceptual model. So more heavy precipitation and more dry days. And that's certainly largely what we see in our high-resolution climate model experiments. We see that everywhere that extreme precipitation changes in a statistically significant fashion, it changes towards more extreme precipitation. And we also see, as I've said, exacerbation of drought, particularly in the Southwest, but also an increase in dry days in the Gulf Coast region, for example. So the climate models support the conceptual model. And as I said earlier, I think that it's simplistic to simply say wet areas will get wetter and dry areas will get drier. There are certainly good reasons that areas could get wetter overall, but with a drier dry season, with the Southwest of the U.S. being a prime example of that.
Well, that makes sense. Where can people find out more about your work?
Well, my my lab group at Purdue has a website, and it's we try to keep it pretty up to date. So as we have various research news appearing in the published literature, we post that on the on our webpage, and that can be found through Google more easily than by any other means. In fact, if I'm trying to go to that webpage, I usually just Google it. So yeah, we're pretty available in the scientific literature as well as on the internet, and that's probably the best place to start.
Great. And finally, I want to ask you, are you worried about the human impact on the climate? Are we headed for difficult times, or do you think we'll manage to handle this?
Well, I'm a climate scientist. I'm not a sociologist, and I'm not a policymaker.
But you're a person.
Well, you know, I keep awfully busy trying to understand how the climate system works, and that it's a very difficult problem, and it takes an enormous amount of energy trying to keep up on that. So, you know, I actually have quite a bit of faith in human ingenuity. I think it's pretty remarkable what we've done, say, even in my grandparents' lifetime. You know, my grandfather remembers the first automobile in town, and heck, we went to the moon well before I was born. So I think that humans are pretty ingenious, and the question is, what is it going to cost to adapt to the changes that we're inducing ourselves, and what sort of priority do we individually and as a society want to put on avoiding some of those potential changes.
I wonder if your grandchildren will remember the last gasoline-powered automobile in town. It could happen. This is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. And direct from Italy, we've been speaking with Dr. Noah Diffenbaugh, a climate specialist from Purdue University. Thank you so much for taking the time to explain these things to us today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Hard rain's going to fall means something's going to happen. Blue-eyed son, and where have you been, my darling young one? I stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked in and crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of 12 dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's a hard rains are gonna fall. Oh, what did you see, my blue-eyed son? And what did you see, my darling young one? I saw a newborn baby with wild wolves all around it. I saw a highway of diamonds with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men with their hammers a-bleeding. I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues were all broken. I saw guns and sharp swords in the hands of young children. And it's a hard rains are gonna fall. Oh, what did you hear, my blue-eyed son? And what did you hear, my darling young one? I heard the sound of a thunder that roared out a warning. I heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. I heard 100 drummers whose hands were ablazing. I heard 10,000 whispering and nobody listening. I heard one person starve, I heard many people laughing. I heard the song of a poet who died in the gutter. I heard the sounds of a clown who cried in the alley. And it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard rains are gonna fall. Oh, who did you meet, my blue-eyed son? And who did you meet, my darling young one? I met a young child beside a dead pony. I met a white man who walked a black dog. I met a young woman whose body was burning. I met a young girl, she gave me a rainbow. I met one man who was wounded in love. I met another man who was wounded in hatred. And it's hard, and it's hard, and it's hard, and it's hard, and it's hard. Rains are gonna fall. And what'll you do now, my blue-eyed son? And what'll you do now, my darling young one? I'm a-going back out for the rain starts a-falling. I'll walk to you the depths of the deepest dark forest, where the people are many and their hands are all empty. Where the pellets of poison are flooding their waters. Where the home in the valley meets the damp, dirty prison. Where the executioner's face is always well hidden. Where the hunger is ugly, where souls are forgotten. Where black is the color and none is the number. And I'll tell it and think it and speak it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. Then I stand on the ocean before I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing. And it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard. Rains are gonna fall.
Well, who else could that be but Bobby Dylan in an old live version of A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall from the No Direction Home film track, I Know What He Means. While NASA's satellites continue to measure the damage from climate change, as usual in the Bush administration, the agency is rotten at the top. Just listen to this outrageous quote from NASA Administrator Michael Griffin, a Bush appointee, this week on National Public Radio.
I have no doubt that a trend of global warming exists. I am not sure that it is fair to say that it is a problem we must wrestle with. To assume that it is a problem is to assume that the state of Earth's climate today is the optimal climate, the best climate that we could have or ever have had, and that we need to take steps to make sure that it doesn't change. First of all, I don't think it's within the power of human beings to assure that the climate does not change, as millions of years of history have shown. And second of all, I guess I would ask which human beings, where and when, are to be accorded the privilege of deciding that this particular climate that we have right here today, right now, is the best climate for all other human beings. I think that's a rather arrogant position for people to take.
Who are we to say the climate we have known for centuries is the best? Just because all the animals and plants, all the life that we can't see, evolved to fit our current climate, there's no reason to keep it, says Griffin. He'd rather spend $100 billion following the Fuhrer's dream of building a Motel 6 on the moon. George Bush says we are going to the moon and Mars, but it would be arrogant to fight for the climate. Utter, utter madness at the top, my friends. The last days in the bunker, the leader still making models for a new city as bombs flatten the one he is in.
The climate is changing three times faster than our worst predictions.
Just who will inherit Anna Nicole Smith's estate? The newly released will does not clear that up.
Don't let them see us. Don't tell them what we are doing. Are these the words of the all-powerful boards and syndicates of the earth? Don't let them see us. Don't tell them what we are doing.
You are tuned to CFRO 102.7 FM, the granddaddy of listener-owned radio in Vancouver, Canada. Remember, we said it's three times worse? That goes for rainfall, too, according to another NASA study published in the online journal Science Express. We know that a warmer atmosphere holds more water. And that falls out of the sky as rain, sometimes very intense precipitation, and deeper snow in some places. Climate modelers have presumed precipitation would increase by 1 to 3% by the end of this century. The new study suggests it could be more like 13% more rain than we experienced in the year 2000. Scientists at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado are also warning about the new rain regime. A warmer sea boosts evaporation, turning storms into airborne water reservoirs, ready to burst. That's in the journal Geophysical Research Letters. Think about that. Most of us will be living in cities that were never designed for that much rain. In fact, the majority of the world's city dwellers don't have storm sewers, or sewers at all, for that matter. Our farmers are not prepared for it either. Not to mention the psychological impact of rain and more rain, even while some parts of the world dry out into deserts. Don't focus on Australia and their 10-year drought. Not even the dry future of places like Phoenix and Las Vegas. Think Vancouver Grey and torrents of rain in the new, hot, wet world. For every 1 degree Fahrenheit temperature increase, the total amount of water circulating in the atmosphere goes up by 4%.
I stand on the ocean before I start sinking, and I'll know my song will before I start singing. And it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard rain's gonna fall.
You know, one of the roots of deep ecology in the United States has been the hatred of the giant dams built across almost every river in America. Most of them killed off the fish and ecosystems, and thousands of them have been abandoned, blocking off the water for no reason at all. Nobody has taken responsibility for really freeing up the rivers. Now we have the new book, Dam Nation. That's two words. The authors may have started out thinking about dams, but they ended up examining every aspect of the way humans use and abuse our most necessary element. We can live without gold, but not without water. We have Cleo Wolfley Erskine on the line, and he is the co-founder of the Gorilla Greywater Girls, but they're now called the Greywater Gorillas. I'm sure we'll get an explanation. And he's touring around for the Water Underground Tour 2007. Do I have that right?
That's true.
Now, there's so many things we can talk about when it comes to water. We're practically made of it, and we all need it very much. What are you focusing on now?
We're focusing on people's personal water consumption, both the water that flows out of their taps, the water that waters the food that they eat, but also the hidden water that's in hydroelectricity or that's in the products that we all consume, and doing a kind of history lesson or kind of search back to the source of all of that water, focusing on dams and the development of dams in the West, and then how that got exported around the world throughout the 20th century, and then moving into kind of practical alternatives to that. So, you know, we got started designing small-scale graywater treatment wetlands, and I can describe those in more detail, but just simple ways that people can take responsibility for their own water use, whether that be catching water from that falls on their roofs or recycling the water that flows out their pipes. So trying to kind of interact with both our personal water consumption and also the larger political issues of water use.
Well, that's a pretty broad spectrum. Now, coming back to our personal use, I know that when I lived in the country, of course, we had gray water, and there's no big municipal system to dump it in, so you have to think about what you're going to do with it. And we also had a bit of land where it was marshy, and we could sort of route it down that way. And I would say that nature probably cleaned it up because we were living fairly cleanly as well. Now, is that the kind of thing that you have written about previously?
Yeah, well, basically what we did is we took that, looked at that natural capacity of wetlands to purify water and adapted it to the situation that we were living in, that Laura and I were living in, which was a very small urban backyard. So basically we constructed a wetland that would filter our water from our shower and then make it very clean so that we could use it to water our vegetable gardens. And I had, before that, I had been living in New Mexico and kind of installing more elaborate versions of that for people who were off the grid and who wanted an alternative to a septic tank leach field. So they were treating black water, which has the toilet water in it as well. But we needed high-quality irrigation water because we were growing lots of vegetables and we had a small space. And so we said, well, why not see if we can adapt this principle to a small area and using recycled materials. And then from that point, we kind of got interested in the backstory of where does our water come from? And the politics kind of grew out of that.
So you've got kind of some rural roots there, and I guess you're at Cortez Island as we speak now, and there are people there going to be interested in this issue, aren't there?
Yeah, I would imagine. We've just arrived, but, you know, like you said, it's pretty basic in a rural setting. You can just kind of route your gray water out to a tree or a marsh or anything like that, and definitely in rural areas it makes a lot of sense.
Well, I guess you know in our provincial capital here in Victoria, we have the best system. We just pump it all straight out into the ocean without any treatment whatsoever.
Well, that's what happened a lot back in the day and still happens in some cities in the U.S. as well. And another problem that we have, I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and another problem that we have is sewers that were built 100, 150 years ago when the cities were much smaller, and that combined the stormwater, that is the street runoff, with the sewage. And
yes,
so
we have that here in Vancouver.
You get a lot of stormwater going down the drains. You have raw sewage spilling out into the bay as well. And so, you know, some of the things that we talk about are how can that stormwater be, you know, captured and reused. And obviously you guys have a lot of water up here in BC, but in some places in the desert that water is a very precious resource. And
well, it looks like
possible.
I think it looks, due to climate change, what's almost happening is the world is splitting into two types of places. Some are very dry and just getting absolutely dry, and we see that in Australia or right now around Lake Okeechobee down in Florida and so on. And other areas are going to get much, much wetter. And so we're going to have two regimes of handling water, aren't we?
That's true. And, I mean, that affects not only drinking water and obviously where people can live because of flooding, but also it definitely affects irrigation and hydroelectricity. And, you know, with global warming, you're going to see decreased snowfall. This is becoming a problem in the Sierra Nevada mountains, and I'd be curious to know if it was a problem here. And then in the spring you have very fast melting, which will of course lead to flooding, and then you don't have the storage capacity in the reservoirs for the rest of the year to generate either hydroelectricity or you know, to irrigate crops. And you know, I grew up in Los Angeles, and I'm from California, and California is one of the major agricultural centers of the world, and yet that agriculture is completely dependent on this network of dams and aqueducts and canals. And so, and you know, both there and on the Colorado and throughout much of the world, the dams were designed with very little foresight, even so far as natural climate fluctuations, much less global warming. And I think that you're right that we're going to see a lot of, you know, increased kind of catastrophic events having to do with water, whether that be drought or flooding or landslides.
And that leads neatly to the book that you're releasing, Damnation. Can you tell us about that?
Well, we really struggled with a title because our first little pamphlet zine that we produced in 2000 was called The Gorilla Greywater Girl's Guide to Water, and it was a very kind of grandiose title for a somewhat modest publication. But as we went on to develop the book, we found that that in tracing the kind of development of dams throughout the world, that there was this real connection between dam building and infrastructure building, especially as it pertained to water, and kind of centralization and control of resources and land. And that, you know, started in the American West in some ways, and then was quickly taken up throughout North America and Europe, but then in the Soviet Russia, USSR, and also in China, you know, there was a tremendous frenzy of dam building, as it were.
Absolutely, and rivers diverted.
Yeah, I mean, hundreds of rivers diverted. In China, there was 80,000 dams built, and no one even really knows how many millions of people displaced. And yet, wherever we trace these dams, be it dams that were built 100 years ago in the American West or dams going up today in Thailand and India, we found this resistance from farmers, from fishermen, from people living on the land, and this real alternative of, you know, watershed-centered regional economy that was connected to the river and that used the water very efficiently and in some ways much more productively than what the agricultural diversions or the hydroelectricity makes use of. And so we kind of had this idea of the water underground being not only, you know, kind of obviously referencing an underground revolutionary movement, but also just the actual water and how it has this capacity to percolate through the soil and continue moving, you know, around dams or under dams or behind dams or through the water cycle, and that just being a kind of an image or a metaphor for the types of decentralized movements that are really trying to create a new water, a new culture of water that's very much in opposition to damnation.
And I think a lot of people don't realize that we know that oil is limited, that we may reach peak oil, we may be there, we're going to run out of this stuff. But they don't realize how limited the fossil water is. There are so many communities in the United States and various parts of the world that are totally dependent now on drawing out fossil water. And that, when those aquifers dry out or are used up or pumped out, as they are in India, the wells are dropping and dropping and dropping. Then what happens with this huge surplus of population and the water is dwindling?
Well, it's a good question, and I mean, I've spent a lot of time in the U.S. Southwest and Arizona and New Mexico, and you know, my own city of Los Angeles was first founded on this abundance of artesian water that came spouting out of the ground wherever you drilled a hole, and now, of course, the water from Los Angeles comes from, you know, 800 kilometers away. And in places where when you suck that water out of the ground, you get, you know, the actual ground sinking and collapsing and the pores in the soil or in, you know, the aquifer that formerly could hold water are sometimes just not available anymore. And it's a really good question. And, I mean, that's something that we kind of talk about in when we're advocating for dam removal or at least a reconsideration of water policy is that, you know, you talk to an urban planner in Tucson, Arizona, and they'll admit that they have enough water for 10 years of growth, and then they're going to have no source of new water. And so, and if there's a drought, and, you know, as there has been for the last 5 years on the Colorado River, there's going to be a serious problem with not only meeting people's water needs, but also generating the hydroelectricity that is used to pump that water over mountains.
And then welcome to South Australia right now on the Murray Darling, where they have to decide, are they going to use the water for irrigation, which produces half of that country's food supply, or will they use it for the people of Adelaide who need water to survive? And they've chosen Adelaide.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're going to see repeats of that situation in different parts of the world as well.
Sure, and I mean, of course, water and oil are interconnected in that you can use oil to pump water. You can also use oil to move food around the globe. Oil is different from water in that it can be a renewable resource if you're using the water that's falling on the land rather than the water that's underneath the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been very inspired by some of the water harvesting strategies that have been developed in Australia and then implemented throughout the world, but also in the Southwest. And just, you know, even in a very dry desert environment, the amount of water that falls on a city is, you know, if you could figure out how to capture and store it, is usually sufficient for the drinking and household needs of the population, if not their lawns and swimming pools. So that's kind of where you have this conflict between this mega water system, but also this existence of technically feasible small-scale alternatives that, granted, would require a change in lifestyle, but could indeed provide that water for much of the world's population.
Yeah, we could live with a lot less water and recycle and reuse and all sorts of things. Now, this book, you've got three authors, and is it a single book? Is it a collection of essays? Can you describe Damnation for us?
Yeah, it's an anthology, and there's three editors, an illustrator, and about 14 different contributors. Basically, it's divided into three sections, and in the first section, we trace the development of the what we call the water grid around the world, looking at both the origins of the mega dam philosophy and recent developments, such as privatization. In the second section, we're looking at these kind of tangible alternatives So gray water recycling, you know, reusing the water that flows from your shower and sink and washing machine, composting toilets, because 30% of the water in the average, you know, modern home is flushed down the toilet, and so there's lots of great and simple dry and composting toilets that can be used as alternatives to that. And then also rainwater harvesting, you know, catching water off your roof, using it for either to irrigate your plants or actually for drinking. And what happened, we had a, and then the third section is kind of chasing some of the other effects of the infrastructure. So we look at the levees in New Orleans and the Army Corps of Engineers being this kind of river channeling monster that created the devastating floods that we saw a few years ago, and in toxic contamination, contaminated fisheries, some of the other fallout from industrial society that affects water and waterways. And so I wrote many of the pieces. Laura Allen, my co-editor and co-founder of the Greywater Gorillas, wrote and researched many of the pieces. But what we also had is we had people who had taken workshops that we had given in, you know, gray water or rainwater or composting toilets and had gone on to develop their own systems. So we got kind of case studies or profiles from a lot of those people on just how they had adapted their these ideas or these technologies to a wide variety of climates and settings, and also have contributions on various topics related to water, to fish, and also to habitat restoration and dam removal.
This sounds like an important book. Is it going to be carried by the major chains, or do we have to look for alternative bookstores?
It is in the major chains, and it's in your alternative bookstore, although, of course, we recommend that you go support your local alternative bookstore. But it is available at Borders and Barnes & Noble and pretty much anywhere that you can think of.
Well, here in town, we kind of support Spartacus Books. But tell me also, what is your website?
Our website is graywatergorillas.com, and that's graywater with a GREYWATERGUERRILLAS.com. And on our website, you can find plans for making your own graywater system, more ideas about different ways to recycle water, as well as more background info on all the topics that I've been talking about, as well as current struggles around dams and dam removal.
So you get the big picture and also some hard data on how to do something yourself.
That's right. I mean, so many environmental books are gloom and doom, and we wanted to give people a way to get their hands dirty and actually change something tangible, even if on a very small scale.
Well, I want to thank you, Cleo Wolfley Erskine, talking to us today about the big picture in water and also what we can do. So thanks a lot for talking with Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
We started this show off with a few bleak warnings. Now every script calls for the sugar coating and a call for action.
Not this radio station.
But this isn't Hollywood or even reality TV. We live in a complex ecosystem, which we are just beginning to understand, even as we blindly wreck it. It's an ironic universe. Deal with it. And yet, there's something in me that wants to try, that wants to survive, to keep nature alive. That's what keeps me broadcasting, and I hope keeps you coming back to Radio EcoShock. You can hear us live on the web every Friday at www.cooperadio.org. If that's not working, try our 24-hour all-environment net radio station at www.ecoshock.org. Except for a few weeks in July, we'll be running this show on the EcoShock channel on Fridays at 1 p.m. and again at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Or tune in by satellite on Star Choice Channel 845, Fridays at 1 p.m. You can find Radio EcoShock on a growing list of college and community radio stations. I hope to publish a list of stations and times on a special new website next fall. We're also working hard to expand into video broadcasts over the net, including YouTube. Look for Video EcoShock releases next fall as well. Meanwhile, you can always download all our past shows free from Radio EcoShock at ecoshock.org. We really appreciate you tuning in. If you have comments, write us at radio@ecoshock.org. Next week, we'll feature a recent speech by car critic and suburban critic James Howard Kunstler. and then the audio from the techie conference called TED 2007. Big leaguer John Doerr delivers an emotional plea for action on climate change, starting out like this.
I'm really scared. I don't think we're going to make it. Probably by now, most of you have seen Al Gore's amazing talk. Shortly after I saw that, we had some friends over for dinner with the family. The conversation turned to global warming, and everybody agreed. There's a real problem. We've got a climate crisis. So we went round the table to talk about what we should do. The conversation came to my 15-year-old daughter, Mary. She said, I agree with everything that's been said. I'm scared and I'm angry. And then she turned to me and said, Dad, your generation created this problem. You better fix it. Wow. All the conversation stopped. All the eyes turned to me. I didn't know what to say. Kleiner's second law is there is a time when panic is the appropriate response. And we've reached that time. We cannot afford to underestimate this problem. We face irreversible and catastrophic consequences. We must act, and we must act decisively. I got to tell you, for me, everything changed that evening.
Then he describes what is happening, some promising new technology, and the tiny chance we'll make it as a civilization in a livable world for our kids. I'm Alex Smith, and here's what I've got to say about that, with Mavis Staples and Rye Cooter. You've been listening to Radio EcoShock on CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
Now this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. All in my home, I'm gonna let it shine. In my room, I'm gonna let it shine, shine. The road is dark, the way was long. Kept on singing that freedom song. My God promised me a rainbow sign. Just gotta let my little light shine. Don't give up, don't back down. Don't let the liar turn you around. My heart's fixed, made up in mine. I'm going out and let my little light shine. Sure gonna let my little light shine. All in the streets, I'm gonna let it shine. On the battlefield, I'm gonna let it shine. See now I ain't gonna fight no rich man's war. That ain't what God wanna use me for. Killing folk ain't in my line. Sure ain't no way to let my little light shine. Shine on me, shine on me. Let the light from the light house shine on me. You can't fool all the people all the time. Get together, let our little light shine. Let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. When the cold, let it shine. When the liar calls, let it shine. In my home, let it shine. In my room, y'all, let it shine. When hatred calls, let it shine. When it shines, freedom shines. When it shines.
night.